Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Out front next, breaking news. The president's chief of staff directly linked to Trump's Ukraine quid pro quo. That's according to two White House officials who testified under oath. Is there any way Mick Mulvaney wasn't acting on behalf of the president? Plus, John Bolton says he has information that's relevant to the impeachment probe, according to his attorney. So when will he testify? And as the Biden-Warren battle gets uglier, Warren is going after loyal Biden voters. Can she win them over? Let's go out front. Well, good evening. I'm Pamela Brown in for Aaron Burnett on this Friday. And tonight, the president's chief of staff orchestrated the quid pro quo. That's according to two White House officials whose closed-door depositions were released today. Fiona Hill, President Trump's former advisor on Russia, and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council, both testified under oath in the impeachment inquiry. And both said it all came back to Mick Mulvaney, the president's right-hand man, a man you'd be hard-pressed to imagine was acting on his own. According to both Hill and Vindman, who testified separately, under oath, again, behind those closed doors, they had been told that Mulvaney was directing the quid pro quo with Ukraine in coordination with Trump's ambassador of the EU, Gordon Sondland. According to the transcript, Vindman was asked, "Do you understand how he, Sondland, came to believe that this deliverable was necessary?" Vindman responds, "So I heard him say that this had been coordinated with White House Chief of Staff Mr. Mick Mulvaney." Question, "Well, what did he say about that?" Answer, "He just said that he had had a conversation with Mr. Mulvaney, and this is what was required in order to get a meeting." And here's how Hill recounted that meeting in her testimony. Quote, "Ambassador Sondland, in front of the Ukrainians as I came in, was talking about how he had an agreement with Chief of Staff Mulvaney for a meeting with the Ukrainians if they were going to go forward with investigations. And my director for Ukraine was looking completely alarmed." So if Ukraine wanted a meeting with the president, they needed to investigate Biden. A quid pro quo that the Ukrainians were made aware of, according to this testimony. And then there's another quid pro quo, this one relating to military aid to Ukraine. According to Vindman's testimony, the hold on the military aid came from the chief of staff's office. And Hill, quote, "It actually came as a direction from the chief of staff's office." Now, of course, Mulvaney has already admitted to the world that there was, in fact, a quid pro quo. Remember this?
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happen as well.
We do that all the time with foreign policy. I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy.
So he later took that back, as we know. But this testimony from Hill and Vindman indicates his initial statement was the truth. Manu Raju is out front now on Capitol Hill. And Manu, you also have some new developments regarding another potential star witness in this impeachment inquiry, John Bolton.
Yeah, that's right. John Bolton is an individual who has been mentioned time and again by a number of witnesses, someone who is central to some of these discussions that were going on and who raised serious objections by the push of by Rudy Giuliani and others to pursue these investigations that could help the president politically, pushing the Ukrainian government to do so. Even Fiona Hill's testimony today showed that she quoted John Bolton as saying that Rudy Giuliani is a hand grenade that is going to blow everything up. Now, in a new letter sent to by Bolton's attorney to Capitol Hill, he reveals that John Bolton has information about events, meetings, and conversations about which you have already received testimony, but about meetings and conversations that have not been discussed in the testimonies so far. And this was revealed in a court case in which Democrats have essentially said that they weren't going to fight to try to get John Bolton to come and testify, because John Bolton's attorney has said that if he were subpoenaed, they would fight this out in court about his client, as well as a separate client who also served under John Bolton. Democrats have no desire to go a prolonged court fight, so they're signaling they're not willing to go this route. But John Bolton's attorney says that if he were to come, he would provide this information. Mm-hmm. But first, they want a court to rule and decide whether or not he is required to come and testify. But that creates a big complication here, Pamela, because Democrats want to wrap up this impeachment probe in the coming weeks, potentially by the end of the year, to actually impeach this president. But if they were going to pursue John Bolton, who could have this key evidence that could delay these proceedings for months. And at the moment, it sounds like Democrats don't want to go that route. Pamela?
All right, Manu, thanks so much. Interesting that that the lawyer is dangling out there. His client, John Bolton, has all this information that hasn't been out there, but yet he wants the court to decide. So let's talk about all of this out front tonight. A member of the House Oversight Committee who was inside the room for the Vindman deposition, Democratic Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton. Thank you so much for coming on. So let's start with what Manu was talking about, this fact that according to John Bolton's attorney, John Bolton has all this knowledge of, quote, many relevant meetings and conversations that have not yet been discussed in the testimonies thus far. Are you willing, are the Democrats willing to put an impeachment vote on hold for another few weeks in order to possibly get John Bolton's testimony?
I can say I think, although we have not discussed this, it just came up, we don't need him. If he wanted to come forward, he should have come forward much earlier. Look where we are. We have got to get this done by the end of December. Our cup runneth over. We've heard from his staff. We've heard from people who were in the room. I think you're dealing with an official who, remember, was fired by Trump. And this could be part of what he is, his comeuppance to Trump. And then he wants to say, well, of course, they made me do it.
So you think we don't need him? You think you have everything you already need for the impeachment?
I'm going to say in the last, well, you've just heard our kind of our first, mm-hmm. our first reveals. Once you hear from a lieutenant colonel decorated and from his supervisor, and the lieutenant colonel was in on the phone call, you're almost there right there.
But what the White House and allies of Trump argue is you still don't have the direct link to the president. Couldn't someone like a John Bolton, the former national security advisor, provide that direct link that the Democrats might need to make the case stronger?
What more direct link can you have than being on the phone call where you heard the president himself? So I do think we have the direct link to the president, and I do think that Bolton would be helpful. But is he going to give us anything more than his staff, who've already come forward and has given us? We've got to ask, why is he so anxious to come forward? And if he's anxious to come forward, why would he say, take me to court and let them decide it?
We talked a lot about quid pro quo being investigations in exchange for military aid, but both Vindman and Hill talked about these investigations needing to happen, being announced publicly in order for a meeting to happen with the president. Vindman even testified, my understanding is this was all about getting the bilateral meeting. Doesn't matter to you, excuse me, if this was about aid or a meeting. That's my question to you. Is quid pro quo all the same, whether it be about aid or the meeting?
Look, it's very important what you ask, because up until now, we have been focused on the money. And of course, they needed that most of all. So why this emphasis mm-hmm. on the meeting with the president? The president wants to look these people in the eye and get as much directly from them on Joe Biden. He wants, yes, the money, but the money he can't withhold but so long. We have already voted in a bipartisan way for the money to go forward. The icing on the cake is the meeting. And there he can have a direct conversation, and perhaps we couldn't overhear that conversation as we have the phone call. And he could learn even more about Biden.
But do you see a situation where there is, you know, Mulvaney and Giuliani and Sullivan are acting without the direction of the president?
Impossible. If so, then he should have fired them all. These people have direct access to the president. Mulvaney is the chief of staff. You mean to tell me he never talks to the president?
So, again, you say that, the Democrats have all you need. But White House sources I've spoken with tell me that basically the White House is banking on the public not fully grasping all these different threads coming out, these different names, that it won't ultimately move the needle for them. It is a tangled web with so many names and, different meetings all over the place when you go through the transcript. Do you really think that all of this is breaking through to the public outside of the Beltway, outside of this bubble?
Actually, not now. I don't think they have been watching these reports. But wait until they testify.
So you think the testimony is really going to be the thing?
It's everything. You're going to see who I saw. You're going to see Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. And when they see this
man...
Well,
he's not on the list so far. Will he be? Are there negotiations right now to have him publicly testify?
I really don't think he'll be able to avoid it. When you see witnesses like that willing to testify directly to what they heard, the most important witnesses will be the witnesses on the call, the witnesses who were closest to the evidence we need. And it seems to me that we have enough of them now that unless we want to be here this time next year talking about this, and remember 2020 is a every member of the House has to run again, I think you've got to finish this up before Christmas.
Okay, Eleanor Holmes Norton, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Appreciate it.
And out front, up next, Trump and Giuliani, the two men still speaking regularly on the phone, even as the impeachment probe is heating up, according to sources I've spoken with. Plus, Trump handpicked him, even praised the job that he was doing.
Gordon Sondland. Thank you, Gordon. Where is he? Great job. Good.
But now he says he hardly knows the man who delivered damning testimony on Ukraine. And breaking news, Michael Bloomberg just filed for a presidential primary. Does this mean he's really running? We'll be right back. Breaking news just released transcripts from the House impeachment inquiry revealing even more officials testifying under oath that they had great concerns about President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani's work in Ukraine. Fiona Hill, a former Russia advisor to President Trump, testifying, quote, I was extremely concerned that whatever it was that Mr. Giuliani was doing might not be legal, especially after, you know, people had raised with me these two gentlemen, Parnas and Fruman. Now, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, of course, two Giuliani associates who were arrested recently while trying to flee the United States. And Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, a top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council, saying this about the July phone call where President Trump urged Ukraine's president to help Giuliani dig up dirt on the Bidens. Frankly, up until that call, you know, in certain regards, he was acting as a private citizen, advancing his own interests to a certain extent. It wasn't until that call that it became that he was pulled into kind of an official role. All right, let's discuss all of this out front now. Greg Brower, who was an assistant FBI director, Carrie Cordero, who was the counsel to the U.S. Assistant Attorney General for National Security. Also with us tonight, former Nixon White House counsel John Dean and former Republican Congressman Charlie Dent. It has been a very busy news day going through these transcripts from two top White House officials. Carrie, to start with you, witness after witness is testifying. They had these concerns about Giuliani. What do you make of this, of all these officials testifying that they knew what Giuliani was up to? They had these concerns.
They did. Well, because there was an individual, Rudy Giuliani, who was not in government, who was doing things that from their perspective, as far as State Department officials or White House officials working on national security related to Ukraine, that he was stepping into interfering with what they were trying to carry out as legitimate foreign policy. So on one hand, you have a person not in government at all who is interfering in national security interests. But then the second thing that it also tells me is that there were a lot of people in the White House who knew what was going on, and it took the whistleblower to actually report it through an official channel and start
this
the fact
the
that we
interesting part of this. I mean, you have
now
Vindman,
that we know about it.
Hill testifying. A lot of people knew about what was going on, but you're right. It was the whistleblower who went through those channels. But what's interesting too is just the view of these officials of Giuliani. You know, they're trying to do their official government work, Greg. Then you have someone going rogue outside doing their own thing. I mean, it kind of painted this picture of pure chaos when it came to Ukraine policy. Fiona Hill testified that John Bolton likened Giuliani to a hand grenade, to a live hand grenade. Do you think that's proven to be true in all of this as you learn more and more and as Giuliani's role becomes more apparent?
Yeah, and not surprisingly so. And there was also the description by John Bolton of, you know, Rudy's drug deal, as if to kind of dismiss
Rudy and Mulvaney. Yeah,
exactly.
And now we have more understand the context around why you said that.
That's right. And it would be hard enough, frankly, to have the national security and diplomatic bureaucracy dealing with some kind of rogue operation if that rogue operation was parallel but legal. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it appears that perhaps it wasn't even a legal rogue operation. That not only complicates things for the government officials who are supposed to be pursuing national security and diplomatic relations, but it creates a whole potentially impeachable situation, and that's how it's playing out.
It is how it's playing out, John, because this is all part of this, the Democrats' impeachment inquiry. I want to bring up what Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified to about Acting Chief of Staff and OMB head Mick Mulvaney. Vindman was asked, do you understand how he, Sondland, came to believe that this deliverable was necessary? And then Vindman responded, so I heard him say that this had been coordinated with White House Chief of Staff, Mr. Mick Mulvaney. Question, what did he say about that? Answer, he just said that he had had a conversation with Mr. Mulvaney, and this is what was required in order to get a meeting. How significant is it to you that he testified that the president's acting chief of staff directed this quid pro quo, essentially?
John. Well, it certainly gets it closer to the president. And, you know, whether they'll claim that the president had no knowledge of this, we don't know yet. Fiona Hill gave the same testimony, which corroborates Vindman. So it's a pretty strong charge, and it certainly puts Mulvaney in the loop. No question about that. And Pamela, I would just point out that this whole thing is just one giant conspiracy to extort or bribe. And it's very conspicuous. It's just no question. And now how deep the president is, that's what the House is going to establish.
And I mean, so do you think this is an impeachable offense then? Because as we know, bribery, according to the Constitution, is an impeachable act, John.
They have managed in this instance to come right within the definition of impeachable offenses because
how,
it is treason, bribery, and high crimes.
But how? But if no one has made that direct link to the president, then how do you make that case that he should be impeached?
Well, you know, it's interesting. With Nixon, when he was impeached, they stayed away from conspiracy charges. There is a reference in the minority report of all places that he conspired, but the majority, the Democrats with Nixon, did not charge him with a conspiracy, although that was very conspicuous in the evidence. So I don't think by precedent they'll try to draw Trump in through conspiratorial actions. They'll look for him being directly involved or enough. They'll look for testimony. And where they're going to find that is in the document, the readout on the call on July 25th.
The call that the president continues to say is perfect. Really quick, and I'm going to go to you, Carrie.
Perfect.
I know you have a thought, but Congressman Dent, President Trump has also had this to say about who the Democrats have called to testify so far.
They shouldn't be having public hearings. This is a hoax. This is just like the Russian witch hunt. This is just a continuation of the hoax. It's a disgraceful thing.
He says none of these witnesses have hurt him. Do you see it that same way? And do you think that how do you think his supporters see it? Do you think that they are seeing this as a continuation of, you know, this being the, quote, hoax?
Oh, I think these witnesses, Taylor, Vindman, Fiona Hill, have done enormous damage to the president because those witnesses are quite credible. And I think I heard the president just say today that he's been the most transparent guy, president we've had in a long time. Well, if he's so transparent and he has nothing to hide, what's so bad about having all this testimony, particularly from his staff, Mulvaney and Giuliani and others? And to answer something that was said earlier to John Dean, you know, if you're the president of the United States, it's assumed that you had knowledge of what your staff was doing. I was chairman of the House Ethics Committee, and we used to have these situations all the time. A member would blame the staff, but we said there was imputed knowledge that the boss should have known what the staff was doing. And you just can't simply dump all this on the staff and get away with it. We would sanction members regularly for actions of their staff.
That's interesting. And what would it say if the president didn't know about what his chief of staff and other key officials were up to? All right. Thank you all for sharing your insights, analysis. Much appreciated. We're going to see you again very soon in the show. Out front next, the president's big donor turned diplomat, Trump's own pick for EU ambassador, is suddenly a stranger after his damaging testimony.
Let me just tell you, I hardly know the gentleman.
And breaking news, Michael Bloomberg on track to make a run for the White House, but would skip early contests in four states. So how does he win? And new tonight, President Trump claiming he hardly knows Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the EU, who changed his testimony this week, suddenly remembering that there was a Trump-Ukraine quid pro quo.
I hardly know the gentleman, but this is the man who said there was no quid pro quo. And he still says that.
So Sondland was handpicked by President Trump to be ambassador and to lead his Ukraine policy. Sondland donated $1 million to Trump's inauguration. And Trump has had glowing things to say about him in the past, tweeting last month, "I would love to send Ambassador Sondland, a really good man and great American, to testify. But unfortunately, he would be testifying before a totally compromised kangaroo court." And that's not all.
Our ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland. Thank you, Gordon. Where is he? Great job. Good.
The text message that I saw from Ambassador Sondland, who's highly respected, was there's no quid pro quo. He said that. He said, by the way, it almost sounded like in general. He said, by the way, there's no quid pro quo, and there isn't.
Everyone back with me now. Carrie, I'm going to go to you first. I meant to go back to you before. Is anyone going to buy this new defense that Trump hardly knew Sondland? And does it show a pattern to you of what the president does in situations where he feels like officials might be saying unflattering things about him?
Right. Well, I think we have seen this pattern with him before where when someone is doing things that he likes, then he's very laudatory towards them. And then when they don't and when he thinks it might be not in his interest, then all of a sudden there's a whole sea of distance between them. The difficulty with the president trying to do that, though, with the testimony of Gordon Sondland or any of these other witnesses, is that all of these facts that come out from the witnesses don't change the essential original information that we have from the original July 25th summary of the phone call that the president himself was on with President mm-hmm. Zelensky. And that's the call where the president asks Zelensky to do him a favor. He mentions investigations of the Bidens. He mentions investigations into this conspiracy about whether Ukraine was involved in the 2016 election. And no matter how much distance he tries to put between him and witnesses, he's not going to be able to get away with the content of that phone call.
What's so interesting about that, we were talking about this, Greg, is it was the White House that put out that transcript. Right. And without that, the actual transcript of the call, it would be a harder case to make that link.
Right? It could be, but you know, it's like welcome to the Twilight Zone here, because we have the call, which clearly puts the president in the middle of this for that exchange with the Ukrainian president. And then we have the president's chief of staff do a press conference at which he concedes, yes, there was a quid pro quo. And we've had every other witness before the committee basically say the same thing. They learned of the quid pro quo either from the call or from other people. They were alarmed by it. And so it's everybody against the president at this point. And, you know, as a former prosecutor, I know Kerry would agree with this. You know, when you have a kind of a lineup of witnesses like that, one against many, it's typically the many who are telling the true version of what happened.
And a lot of this is politics, strategy from the White House, from GOP allies of the Trump, Congressman Dent. We're seeing them throw the people around Trump involved with Ukraine under the bus. They are arguing they each acted without Trump's knowledge. Some of this has been on display this week.
Anytime there was direct conversations with the president, there was no linkage. So any linkage that has been alleged, obviously, is based on many times second or third hand information, either Rudy Giuliani or people believing that they understood what Rudy Giuliani might have wanted.
It is Sondland's opinion. These are all folks' opinions.
Well, he says that in his statement. Yeah. He says it was his presumption.
Yeah.
So that's not based on the fact. It was his presumption.
So you served with those men, Congressman. What do you make of this apparent new strategy? Is it effective?
No. I mean, trying to throw all these people under the bus is simply not going to fly. Nobody's going to believe for a second that Mick Mulvaney or Rudy Giuliani was acting on their own without any consultation with the president. I think just like Michael Cohen, you know, who believes that, Michael Cohen paid off Stormy Daniels, didn't he? He paid him off. He just did that on his own. The president didn't direct him to do it. I mean, same thing here. Of course, these people were operating under the direction of the president. They may try to throw these guys under the bus, and they'll do it in this order. They'll throw Sondland under the bus, then Mulvaney, and then Giuliani in that order. But I don't think it's going to be effective. I think it's laughable. The facts are simply not on the president's side. The noose is tightening. The quid pro quo has been established. All these people who have spoken up did so out of concern for national security and also because of interference in our election. So these are more distractions, not going to be effective.
And what's interesting here, John, is that the president has repeatedly and publicly embraced Giuliani's work in Ukraine, which included trying to dig up dirt on the Bidens.
We've been investigating on a personal basis through Rudy and others, lawyers, corruption in the 2016 election.
Rudy's looking to also find out where the phony witch hunt started, how it started, and I think he's got a very strong right to do it. He's a good lawyer. He knows exactly what he's doing, and it's very important.
Oh, I stand behind Rudy Giuliani, absolutely.
And Rudy has said that he was acting on his client's behalf in regards to Ukraine. Based on these comments, John, if Republicans try to throw Giuliani under the bus, doesn't that effectively throw the president under the bus, too?
I would think that could be very dangerous for the Republicans to do it. And I would think Trump would tell them to stay away from that strategy. Rudy, at some point, if he sees himself being discarded by the White House, being discarded by the Republicans, and on his way to the Bureau of Prisons for a long stay, he's somebody that can give up the president because there is a crime fraud exception in the attorney-client privilege that Trump can't block his testimony if that happened.
And crime fraud exception, Carrie, is if there is an ongoing crime, right, that means that the lawyer is privy to, involved with, that doesn't make the lawyer immune. It remains to be seen if Giuliani will testify. The way things are going, it certainly doesn't seem so. But what's so interesting here is sources tell me that the president continues to talk to Rudy, mm-hmm. that as recently as late October, he was the one calling Rudy up about once a day to talk to him, despite all of these revelations coming out in this testimony about Ukraine. He really seems undeterred by it. What do you make of that?
Well, he is. I mean, he's a close advisor. He's been a close advisor of the president for a long time, and the president has trusted him. And so I think he's been a central advisor. I think Rudy Giuliani has a difficult claim of attorney-client privilege to begin with, because the things that he's doing, if he's running around Ukraine trying to dig up political information for the president's political interests, that's not giving legal advice.
Yeah.
The attorney-client privilege has to do with a lawyer providing legal advice to a client.
What? This might be a silly question, but like, what makes something an attorney-client privilege? We know Rudy said he's done it pro bono, and like, what provides that protection?
There has to be an attorney-client relationship, and the communications in question have to be for the purpose of giving or receiving legal advice. And there cannot be an exception like the crime fraud exception that applies to the mm-hmm. situation. So that's basically it. But look, I think it's clear that Rudy knows everything about this Ukrainian deal. And so to the extent the president continues to talk to him, I think the common sense explanation is that he wants to keep Rudy close so as to be able to try to control Rudy and what he says publicly.
And I wouldn't be surprised if he's doing that with Mick Mulvaney as well. All right. Thank you all. Out front, up next, breaking news. Michael Bloomberg takes a step closer tonight to running for president. Does he have a chance? And a new book claims White House officials weighed resigning en masse. What stopped them? We're going to discuss up next. Breaking news, Michael Bloomberg taking a major step tonight toward running for president, officially filing for Alabama's Democratic presidential primary. Bloomberg is reportedly concerned about the current candidates and their ability to beat President Trump. Well, Joe Biden responding tonight.
Every single poll is run. I beat him like a drum, as I said. There's in states in the South and states in the Midwest and states around the world. So, look, if he wants to run, he should just get in and run.
You're not taking it personally.
No.
Out front now, Matt Paul, a Democratic strategist who met with Bloomberg about a potential 2020 run. He is also senior vice president for Cornerstone Public Affairs. Also with us, Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. Thank you both for coming on. Matt, to you first. Does Bloomberg really think he has a chance of beating President Trump?
Well, I don't think he would have done this, Pam, if he didn't believe that he had a shot. When we talked in 2018, it's been a while since we chatted, but he said, look, I'm going to consider this if I believe I can win. So clearly something has happened from...
Why do you think he does?
From his... Why do I think he's taking a look at this? Because he cares about the country. He's interested. It's no secret to anybody that he's long expressed an interest in running and being the president of the United States. I don't think there's any question about that. But this is hard for him. We're 87 days away from Iowa. 97% of Iowa precinct locations are locked in. Campaigns have been on the ground there for over a year, working hard to organize it. So I think this is a challenge, but listen, I don't think anybody should underestimate Mike or the team that he will put around him.
And Joan, let's look at this recent New York Times poll of head-to-head matchups in swing states. Biden was barely beating Trump and the other candidates trailed him. Does Bloomberg have a point that the current field isn't strong enough?
Look, I think a lot of people, a lot of centrist Democrats are very concerned about Joe Biden. I saw the vice president say in that clip, you know, I'm not taking this personally. He should take it very personally. It's personal. This is coming out of a real perception that he's a weak front runner. But on the other hand, you know, first of all, this lane, this centrist lane, is so crowded already. I think the person that this helps the most, frankly, is Elizabeth Warren. The person that he's out to stop, along with Bernie Sanders, is Elizabeth Warren. And I think this really elevates her and wounds Biden.
It's interesting, though, because I was talking to a source close to the Trump campaign who said, actually, this could be good for Trump because the Democrats will be focusing their fire more on you know, Bloomberg rather than on Trump. It could take some pressure off. Do you buy that, Joan?
No, I don't buy that. I think they have plenty of fire for Trump. And you know, I think a lot of them are just going to ignore Bloomberg. I mean, you know, Pam, you could have a debate here between Michael Bloomberg and Michael Bloomberg, because we have so much tape of him explaining very candidly and clearly, in my opinion, why he can't win, why there's no path. So I agree with Matt. He's a smart man. I can't believe he's going to waste his money. But
let's talk about what this path could be, because we're learning, Matt, Bloomberg's advisors say he plans to skip the first four early contests, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina. No one has done this successfully. You advised Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign in Iowa. Can he win without those states?
Well, it's not been done before. I do think it's important to point out there's been a lot of talk about Mike, and he's certainly successful. He is a self-made guy. I think it's important to remember he's also been very involved and done his politics, I think, wisely. He's been a strong supporter of climate, bringing attention to climate change and the need for policy there. He's done more on supporting choice in women's health care. He's done a ton on gun safety and the need for common sense gun reform in the country. So he does have strong chops. It's more than his money. But I think one thing he's going to have to figure out is how does he thread this needle and move forward, especially if it's Mayor Pete. I think this is an important consideration. I think there's a big impact on Vice President Biden's money, which is already a challenge for the Biden campaign. I think it's also this path, if it's not Elizabeth Warren as our nominee or coming out of Iowa, which the two are closely related, then this path is tougher. And I think it's tough if it's Mayor Pete, because he's built such a coalition quickly and importantly in this election.
And you talked about, Matt, some things that could work in Bloomberg's favor in terms of his record. But there are other parts that will no doubt and are already coming under scrutiny, such as stop and frisk, how that could impact voters.
Exactly.
One source I spoke to close to the Trump campaign said, when it comes to, you know, Trump versus Bloomberg, if that ever happens, said, look, the president has been battle tested over the last several years. Michael Bloomberg hasn't, obviously, in the same way. The question is, can he take a punch? And the president today was asked about all this. He seems to relish a fight with Bloomberg. Here's what he said.
Little Michael will fail. He'll spend a lot of money. He's got some really big issues. He's got some personal problems, and he's got a lot of other problems. There is nobody I'd rather run against than little Michael, that I can tell you.
So what do you think about that, Joan? What do you think of that potential matchup?
Well, I think Michael has a lot more money than Donald Trump. He's a really, truly successful businessman, so he should think about that. But to go back to something that Matt said, Mayor Pete is very impressive right now, but he has not pulled together a solid coalition. He doesn't have black voters in his coalition. And right now, I have to say, Michael Bloomberg starts, as you just talked about, Pam, with a real, I think, in the hole with a lot of black voters, because he continued to defend stop and frisk even after it was found unconstitutional. So you've got black voters who are going to be a tough sell. I don't see him being like Mr. Rust Belt guy. He's going to go back in and take Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. That I'm not feeling that either. So the last person who tried this was his predecessor, Rudy Giuliani. He was going to go into Florida in 2008, and we know we never saw President Giuliani.
All right. Well, we shall see how this all plays out. Thanks so much, Matt and Joan. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, out front, up next, how far were senior Trump officials willing to go to stop the president? Mass resignations were reportedly on the table. So why did they end up staying? And Elizabeth Warren is trying to win powerful Latino votes with a pitch that may pay off.
I am open to suspending deportations.
Tonight, a midnight self-massacre. The anonymous author behind the new book, A Warning, claims that a group of senior Trump administration officials considered resigning en masse last year to warn about the president's conduct, but ultimately decided against it. They feared a mass resignation would further destabilize the government. It's just one of the many revelations from the person who wrote the New York Times op-ed last year titled, I Am Part of the Resistance Inside the Trump Administration. Out front now, Jennifer Zelai, the New York Times nonfiction book critic who reviewed this book. Thanks for coming on, Jennifer. Now, this author is claiming to be a senior Trump administration official. They claim that there was this plan to have a bunch of officials quit at once. What more can you tell us about what the author says about that incident?
Right. So the author doesn't say very much other than to say that it was something that was considered at some point during the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. And then the idea was abandoned. And so, you know, that is one of the big revelations of this book. But it's a revelation about a road that actually wasn't taken.
Yeah, and so that raises this question of what evidence this author has to back up these damning accounts, you know, painting this picture of an incompetent president, someone who is dangerous and disturbing, who shouldn't be trusted with running the government. In one case, the author describes what it's like dealing with the president's tweets, writing, it's like showing up at the nursing home at daybreak to find your elderly uncle running pantless across the courtyard and cursing loudly about the cafeteria food as worried attendants try to catch him. Only your uncle doesn't have to lead the U.S. government once he puts his pants on. Now, you know, that is a very vivid analogy, but what details does the author use to back that up?
Well, so I think that this is sort of the big question with this book, which is because Anonymous is really committed, at least for now, to remaining anonymous and to not revealing his or her identity, you know, he or she says right at the beginning that there's not going to be too many specific details or too many even details that would necessarily give away who this person is. So ultimately, you know, it's like an anonymously sourced book where you just have to trust what the person is saying and trust that it's true. I mean, there is indication that this is a senior level official. There are sort of things that are mentioned that other people have said to this person. So this person seems to be trusted by other people on staff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the same time, we just have to take this person's word for it, which is sort of, I mean, this is sort of the naughty problem of this book, I think.
Quickly, you know, the White House responded calling this person a coward for remaining anonymous. How do you think this author will be remembered?
You know, I think we'll have to see. I mean, I would not be surprised if the identity of this person is revealed at some point. I mean, the person who did write this book also does say that he or she may choose to reveal his identity in case it would help further the cause of the argument of this book. So I guess we'll see.
We'll see. They say they don't want to reveal their identity now because they don't want to become the centerpiece of the conversation.
Right.
They want it to be about the revelations in the book. We shall see. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And out front, up next, Latino voters could propel a Democrat into the White House. Is Elizabeth Warren that candidate? Tonight, Elizabeth Warren making a big pitch to Latino voters. Warren revealing she would consider suspending all deportations as a bargaining chip for immigration reform. Leila Santiago is out front.
Her cry comes with her story. Her husband, she says, still detained by ICE. Through a translator at the Mi Gente town hall, she asks Senator Elizabeth Warren,
will you pass a moratorium on deportations?
I am open to suspending deportations, particularly as a way to push Congress for comprehensive immigration reform.
That's new for Warren, not included in her immigration plan.
Good to see you too.
After the town hall, we asked,
you're leaning toward one way or another a moratorium on deportations, given that yesterday Senator Sanders' plan does include that, and you were asked that today.
So the way I would describe it is I should not be spending its resources deporting people who pose no threat to us.
So is that a yes?
Well, it's a don't spend your resources on our neighbors and our friends.
As Warren made her case, three daughters of immigrants sat in the front row, now eligible to vote.
In 2020, I'm looking for a candidate that will not only show their support for immigrants like me, who have college degrees, who are fluent in English, who have upward mobility. I'm looking for a candidate who will support my parents, who will fight for people like my parents.
Barbara Sustaita is part of a fast-growing piece of the potential electorate. Hispanics are projected to make up more than 13% of eligible voters in 2020, according to the Pew Research Center, possibly exceeding the share of black voters for the first time. And she says focusing on immigration is not enough to win her vote.
Healthcare and education is up there. But now, after El Paso, we see Latinos actually really worried about discrimination against Latinos and immigrants.
Sergio Garcia Rios is an expert on Latino and government studies. He argues Latinos will be critical in states like California, Arizona, Florida, Texas in 2020. But they shouldn't all be courted the same way by candidates.
Are you doing anything different for the Latino voters themselves?
I think showing up is critical.
Okay.
And I also think talking about what would touch their lives is critical. And part of that is about immigration, but it's also about education.
As 2020 candidates figure out the best way to reach the Latino community, plans, town halls, tweets, Sustaita insists candidates must understand the diversity within the Latino community.
And I spent a lot of time talking to Latino voters today here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I had voters tell me that they felt that the Democratic Party at times took their vote for granted and acknowledged their past relationship with the last Democratic president, really celebrating President Obama for what he did for Dreamers, but also saying they haven't forgotten that he was known as the deporter in chief. All right, Leila, thank you so much for bringing us the latest there from North Carolina. And coming up on Monday, Aaron hosts a Democratic presidential town hall with Joe Biden. That's at 9 p.m. Eastern, only on CNN. Thanks for joining us. AC360 starts now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.